Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
I think I would now like to just welcome our introducer, Bradley Bennett. He's the executive editor of the South Florida Times that you've been enjoying, and he'll introduce our special guest.
Okay, sir.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We at the South Florida Times, you can see our paper there in front of you, are pleased to welcome you to the Miami Book Fair International. For those of you who are not familiar with our paper, we are a community weekly publication that focuses on the African American and Caribbean communities of Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties. And you can find our paper in most public supermarkets in Miami-Dade and Broward, or at Johnson and Wales University, and various other locations throughout the region. You can also check us out at our website, sfltimes.com, which is updated daily. And now it's my pleasure to introduce two gentlemen whom I consider kindred spirits, because they, like I, have extensive backgrounds in newspaper journalism. They've also made the issue of race relations a major focus of their work, as I have. First, I'd like to introduce Christopher Keneally, who is going to be our moderator today. He's an award-winning journalist and author who's reported on education, business, travel, culture, and technology for the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Los Angeles Times, the Independent of London.
You can stop there. I was a freelance writer. I had to eat what I killed. So.
Many other leading publications.
That's right. So I'll go on.
He's currently director of author and creator relations for Copyright Clearance Center, and co-host and host and moderator of Beyond the Book, a series on issues in writing and publishing, which is frequently broadcast nationally on C-SPAN's Book TV. And Mr. Keneally lives in Boston. Today's program, titled Uncovering Race Coverage, What We Mean When We Write on Race, Politics, and the American Scene, is a Beyond the Book panel discussion featuring Mr. Woods, Mr. Keith Woods, who is the Dean of Faculty of the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, which is just an extraordinary journalism school that many of us have either gone to or would like to go to, because they have many series on teaching about journalism itself. Mr. Woods is a former sports writer, news reporter, city editor, editorial writer, and columnist who worked his way through those jobs in 16 years at the New Orleans Times-Picayune. His professional writing won statewide and national awards, including the 1994 National Headliner Award he shared with colleagues for the 1993 series Together Apart, The Myth of Race. He joined Poynter in 1995 and for 7 years led the Institute's teaching on diversity and coverage of race relations as part of the ethics faculty. In his time at Poynter, he has written columns and essays on topics ranging from fatherhood to race relations to the emerging journalism of the South African press. Mr. Woods leads seminars for journalists who must handle stories about race and ethnicity. He is a former editor of Best Newspaper Writing, Poynter's annual collection of prize-winning stories and photojournalism selected by the American Society of Newspapers. He's also a regular speaker at the Poynter-sponsored National Writers' Workshops, which is also just a prize thing to go to for many of the journalists who get excited about this. Each year, and consults with newspapers and TV stations on matters of diversity, race relations, writing, and editing. So, with that, I will.
And if I can, I'll introduce the third member of the panel here. This is Bradley Bennett, executive editor. He didn't know when he walked in. He thought he was just going to have the easy job of introducing Keith and me and passing out his papers. But I said, why don't you join us? And he was a good sport, so he's going to have a seat and join us as well. Well, thank you all for coming. And I've I've taken the occasion to ask Keith to read something that was published today in the Times-Picayune, an essay which I'll just allow him to set up, but which I think does a lot to prepare us for the conversation we're going to have. Keith.
Thank you, and I will read excerpts so that you don't have to live through the whole thing. But it's as I struggled on election night with a definition of what this meant, that Barack Obama was being elected president of the United States, I also wrestled with a question that a former colleague in New Orleans had asked in requesting that I write something after the election. And his one strong request was that I wait and not begin even imagining what I would write until the election itself, even though polls and everything else had sort of told you where this would wind up. And I'll just read you an excerpt from that, and by way of talking about how difficult and maybe how hopeful issues of race relations might be. So here we go. Election night had come with high expectations and good poll numbers, and my friend started early in asking, "How do you feel?" And unspoken but understood in that probe of emotions was the rest of their sentence. As a black man, I didn't have words, which was as perplexing to me as to them. This should have been easy. "Wait," I told them. "Let the numbers add up, and when Ohio and Pennsylvania and a southern state or two go blue, I'll know. I'll feel it. You be the first." It was as if we didn't all know the requisite answer. It's an answer that was preordained by slavery, segregation, lynchings, and every time I ever felt the bigoted inferiority that America spent so much time trying to brand upon the souls of black folk. How would I feel? Before this historic election, I thought I knew. I would feel victorious, vindicated, proud, wistful in remembering the ones who suffered and died so that a clever freshman senator with a provocative name could rise to the podium in Grant Park while in the crowd and in our living rooms, we would cry. Only I didn't. My head and heart were in full rebellion against the black man inside me, the one who wanted to slap a high five on black America and do a rooster walk around white supremacy's sad little carcass. Instead of prancing a cocky strut, though, I was cringing at every suggestion that this racial history we were about to make was the big story of the 2008 election. I was trying to understand why focusing on this monumental first felt so small, even insulting. Then Virginia was Obama's, and Florida was flipping, and then the CNN graphics were flying all over the TV screen because the West Coast vote was done, and so was Senator John McCain. And I'll leap forward in the piece to come to the conclusion that I was heading toward as I was trying to understand for myself what I was feeling. I talked about the bitterness of listening to the hoots during John McCain's concession speech. But in one change has come to America leap. He was past the tribute, Obama, to his white grandmother and beyond the familiar signposts of race. Even when he evoked the hauntingly prescient "I've been to the mountaintop" speech that King delivered the night before his death, Obama had bent the words in such a way as to make the black man in me rest and make the American rise. King foretold some difficult days ahead. Obama said, "The road ahead will be long." "I've been to the mountaintop," said King. "Our climb will be steep," said Obama. Said Martin, "I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land." And Barack, "We may not get there in 1 year or even in one term, but America, I have never been more hopeful than I am tonight that we will get there. I promise you, we as a people will get there." And I understood. We were becoming the nation we claimed to be in 1776, proved we weren't in 1968, doubted in cynical hearts scarred by memory that we would be on the morning after November 4th, 2008. We were a new we, a new people. We were not just the dozens of euphoric black folk in Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. We were also the jubilant people of Honolulu, exalting a native son. We were the richly diverse hundreds of thousands in Grant Park and the 63 million across the country. But not only that, we were triumphant Indonesian children waving a picture of the president-elect who once attended their elementary schools, the Kenyans dancing in the dusty streets of Kogila, celebrating a grandchild of Africa, the Australians in Sydney counting down the seconds before the California polls closed, then erupting in cheers for the people's victory. The calm, centered man with a biography that defies category had called upon the nation's people to rise above what their lesser selves feared and see ahead to what they aspired to be. And we proved better than we dared believe. We have not so much transcended racism as we have hurdled the construction work on the bridge between where we were and where we wished to be. This was the ground the rebels in my head and heart had been fighting to take. Go tell the headline writers, the pundits, the black man in me, that this was not merely a racial milestone. We stand together as a nation, as a world, as a people, irrevocably in this new place, more powerful than we have ever been. I can write those words and believe them. Now I can cry.
Well, thank you, Keith, and I think that that went a long way to setting us up here. And the first question I was going to ask you about was, as a journalism professor, how you grade the coverage. And I should tell people that when we first talked about this panel, it was last spring. And we anticipated history would be made one way or the other. At that point, I believe the nomination was on paper his, if not the primary election was not yet over. And I think in a way we've anticipated something, because I think next year we can expect a lot of books on the election to be discussed here at the Miami Book Fair. But to return to that question, how do you grade the coverage? Maybe separate the primary coverage from the final election coverage, and tell us what you thought about some high points and some low points.
Well, I think it depends on what the on what coverage we're talking about. If the question is about race relations, that's and true, how well we covered race relations, I would say not very well at all. And that's not to say that there were a lot of bad stories being written about race relations, so much as it is to say that there weren't many at all for an issue that is. Am I not close enough?
No, you're fine, but you can take it. Hold it.
Oh, but my hand will shake.
Well, that's okay. Yeah, just you're fine.
So I'll get closer. I'm much better, more comfortable this way. Here's an interesting thing about this campaign, and Chris and I talked about this the other day. I've talked to many editors over time who have celebrated the fact that Barack Obama did not make a big deal out of race while running for president, and I wonder why they're celebrating. I've even as recently as last week asked some that question. What's to celebrate about that? If you sat down and arrayed the issues that confront the United States on a daily basis, that confront children in schools, that confront people in a criminal justice system, that confront us in social services and neighborhoods and all of the areas that we are trying to live our lives, race relations and problems within it is one of our biggest problems. It is one of the nation's biggest ongoing challenges. And the fact that we now have a black president tells us the limitations, the boundaries around racism, and the degree to which we've exploded those boundaries. But we cannot imagine for a second that we have resolved those issues that confront my black children in school today, every day, when expectations for them may be low, when their schoolmates may still be taunting them with names, all of the things that are true about the country. country. So I think what we did as a journalism profession was said, okay, they're not talking about it, and therefore neither will we. And I think that was a huge mistake. And I think to the extent that it was problematic, I believe, politically for Barack Obama to take this on, which may be one of the reasons that I'm not going to read anyone's mind why he didn't bring it up other than in Philadelphia when he was forced. It is not our responsibility as journalists to sit around and wait for the candidates to tell us what to talk about. And journalism has a responsibility to provoke and array those issues that are of concern to the people of the United States and report on them as deeply as possible. And I don't think that we did that up to the level that we should have.
So in a sense, you're saying the media let themselves off the hook.
Yeah, I would say that they allowed the candidates to let themselves off the hook, I guess.
There was a complicity there.
Sure there was.
In a sense.
Sure there
yes.
was. And I remind people over and over and over again that John McCain did not talk about race either. Hillary Clinton did not talk about race either. The only person, in fact, who ran in this election cycle who did was John Edwards. And even that was a blip on the radar screen if you go back in the campaign.
Well, one of the things that, as we were anticipating doing the program, Keith, we sort of began to think about was the code that goes along with discussing race in this country and then gets transferred into media coverage. And you had mentioned some interesting points that for you felt like echoes of previous generations. And one in particular that I really found quite helpful to me to understand was this decoding, this unpacking you did of the phrase that he's not ready. To talk about that and take us back to a previous generation and what that meant then.
Well, there were so many things that happened over the course of these last 2 years that were required some generational and historical knowledge to even understand fully, to understand why people were reacting as they were. There was a phrase, I think, at some point, and I don't remember the senator who used it, but referring to Obama as uppity. Now, you have to have a generational knowledge. You have to, in some cases, even have a regional knowledge to know why people reacted as they just did in this room to the phrase. But what's happened in our conversations in general about race and race relations is that we've now mixed over the course of time generation, region, history, knowledge so much that you can't really know from any one moment to the other even who means what when they say it. But what we do know is that people react consistently in some ways to phraseology. So he's not ready has lots of levels of meaning. And again, the older you get, and maybe the other phrasing that we used toward the end of this campaign that we heard a lot was what he will do to our country. And the country that we've created if Obama was elected. And you don't have to be a bigot to have what you do have the consequence of bigotry. You don't have to be a bigot in order to stoke and make use of bigotry in a campaign. And I think to a certain extent, ignorance is only an excuse so far. And then you have to be held responsible. But the journalism has a responsibility to understand that when someone says something like that, he's not ready, that the underlying signals to certain segments of our society that says that we're not ready, that says that that a young person or a black person can't be ready, has to be unpacked in the media. Displayed in front of people, and then I guess to a certain extent confronting the people who said it with the question, is this what you meant? Did you mean, in fact, to invoke the rest of that phrase when I say uppity?
And in fact, you told me that the "he's not ready" phrase was a response in you know from white Southerners at the early days of the civil rights movement, saying, "Oh yes, yes, fine, but not right away." There was a tempering and said, "Well, no, we'll have to wait." That kind of related to that.
Right. What Martin Luther King called the intoxicating drug of gradualism. There is this overriding notion that I can both be liberal enough to say it's okay and still maintain control by saying, just not yet. And none of those things may have been true. I think what's important journalistically is to understand that when those words come from someone's mouth and enters into the various filters of our society, journalism has a responsibility to help us figure out what the person meant, what they didn't mean, what you heard and what he heard, and how those things might be different. And there again, I don't think that we did a good enough job of doing that.
There was a phrase when the election was final, and, you know, I haven't done any research, a Lexis search of the database to determine whether or not this is true, but my gut tells me that more often than not, Obama was referred to as the first African-American president and less so the first black president. And when we were discussing that, we related that to Jesse Jackson's campaigns and how Jackson seemed to play a role of bridging the civil rights movement to this new generation of Obama politics. Do that unpacking again for us. Where and when did African American emerge as a more common way to refer to the community? And if I see Bradley wants to contribute, feel free.
I was going to let.
Okay, well, either one of you. But I think it matters. And tying it to Jackson's campaign and a forgotten phrase that you and I resurrected yesterday when we were discussing it, the rainbow.
Oh, the Rainbow Coalition. Well, I let me just say a few things about this. First, Jesse Jackson, I think, single-handedly pushed the phrase African-American into the American lexicon in the late 80s and early 90s. It was a very deliberate attempt to change language from both Afro-American, which is... And I always thought it was an interesting term anyway, especially at the time when I was wearing an afro, and black, and at some level to force into the American lexicon a phrasing that gives this group of people a beginning point, that takes them out of being a color and places them somewhere in the history of the world by the naming. Now, I don't imagine to know everything that was behind that, but I do know that when it came into particularly into newsrooms, it was an especially compelling question to be asked, because the question is, who gets to tell you what you're called? Who gets to name you? And that debate, by the way, is not over. In newspapers, if you are Latino or Hispanic or Chicano, then somebody's making a decision every day about which one to call you. If you're Native American or Native people or Indigenous people, all of those things are still, they're still going on in our newsrooms. So you have the introduction of the phrase. We talked about the possibility maybe that Jesse Jackson's campaign fell sort of midway. At least sociologically, between our deepest past in race relations and today, the other thing that I pointed out to Chris was that when people talk about Obama not running a race campaign, the suggestion in reflection is that Jesse Jackson did, when in fact his campaign was all about what he called the Rainbow Coalition. The reflection would be that Shirley Chisholm ran a racial campaign. Of course she didn't. Or that Carol Moseley Braun or even Al Sharpton were running racial campaigns. And if you go back and look at the campaigns themselves, they were campaigns for presidency of the United States. And a lot of our memory is about how we felt, particularly as journalists, about who those people were. And it is one of the reasons I believe today that we are still in awe of the fact that a black man ran for president and didn't make race an issue. The problem isn't what the revelation here isn't what Obama did, it's what we expected. It's what we thought he was gonna do, or maybe even should have done. That's what we're learning here. We've learned less about Obama in this campaign than we have about ourselves and our expectations.
And there were some interesting twists and turns in all of that. There was a moment, I believe, late spring, early summer, when he made essentially a joke, a humorous comment, which I believe he had said many, many times, about not looking like all the presidents on the dollar bills. And the McCain campaign used that as an opportunity to say that the Obama campaign was somehow accusing them of being racist. And again, help us as a good journalism professor to unpack all of that and what you heard in that exchange and how it was covered.
Okay, I am not a journalism professor. Can we put that on the
record?
Oh,
I'm sorry.
All the journalism professors in the room, stand down. I'm not trying to...
But you run a journalism school, so maybe that's close enough. Huh? This discussion.
And let me again put it in the larger context of reporting and writing about race relations, that the McCain camp, after Obama had said this, he'd said it a number of times, but like many things that happened over the course of this campaign, it got its moment. Everything kind of suddenly becomes an issue, though it might not have been an issue the day before, because of whatever else was happening in the context of the campaign at that moment. But in this case, the McCain campaign responded to that phrase by saying that Obama is, quote, playing the race card from the bottom of the deck. And maybe you remember, there's so many things that happened over the course of this campaign, it's hard to remember all of the little ones. Well, the first responsibility of journalism is to say, what does that mean, playing the race card? Does it mean talking about race? Does it mean complaining that you have been the victim of discrimination? Does it mean crying wolf? What exactly does the phrase mean? And we've lost track, like political correctness, of what the phrase means, and we're just tossing it about as though we're all sitting around saying, oh yeah, I've got my little decoder device here, I can say playing the race card obviously means the same thing to all of us, and it doesn't. So that was the first problem. In fact, I've written about how many news organizations didn't even put the phrase in quotation marks, but accepted it as a phrase that we all share, and we do not. I don't know what it means when you say it, and I don't know what it means when one person says it to the next. So it's a useless phrase for in the beginning. But beyond that, the notion that Obama, in saying that I don't look like those other people, is interpreted immediately, and I believe that he sort of made use of the ambiguity of this himself, but that it's immediately interpreted to mean I am not white. It also, of course, could have meant I am not old. It could have meant I am not from this region or that region. It could mean that I was not born of privilege. It could mean a number of different things that a simple question back to the candidate would have cleared up. A pure journalistic question, sir, what do you mean when you say that? But of course, it's not in McCain's camp's interest to ask that question, and so they tossed the race card comment in. And journalism, instead of stopping and saying, wait a second, we're journalists, we are not political pundits, we're supposed to ask questions, not run with what we've heard, didn't ask the question enough and say, what do you mean? What does the phrase mean?
And I want to follow that with something about another much more lighthearted moment. But again, you know, you're asking the question, what does he mean? And the point you made just then about the deliberate ambiguity. Obama is, after all, besides a senator and now a president-elect, a best-selling author, a man who knows how to craft a sentence and write a book or two. And so when he says things, he's very deliberate about what words he chooses. And I'm thinking of the exchange in the first news conference just after the election, when they were asking about the dog that they were going to get for his daughters. And certain breeds were mentioned, and he said, well, maybe we'll get a mutt like me. And you said that people interpreted that immediately in one way, and that they shouldn't do that. They should be much more careful. Talk about that.
Well, again, I was sitting around a table of colleagues watching the press conference, and the woman next to me visibly winced. She responded, and she said, I wish he hadn't said that. And what did he mean when he said mutt? Did he mean that I am black and white? Did he mean that I am Kenyan and American? Did he mean that I am from Kansas Honolulu, Indonesia, Chicago, Harvard,
Columbia.
Columbia University. What do they mean? Well, if you assume always that the prism through which you see things is limited, then you ask the question. If you assume that the prism through which you see things is truth, you don't. And I think that journalistically, our curiosity has been blunted to some extent, maybe by arrogance, maybe by a deeper sense that we already know, and so we don't ask questions. Mm. But I would again press the question back. Does anybody know what he meant when he said it? Because I didn't hear the follow-up question in the press conference, and I haven't seen anything written that suggested it could have meant more than the one thing that we assumed when we heard it.
It's fascinating, and I think that I'm going to go and watch all those press conferences much more carefully now, because that follow-up question becomes really important.
Sure.
I have some other thoughts for Keith, but I want to drag Bradley into this. Bradley Bennett from the South Florida Times. You had the fortune, if you will, of starting up the paper just before the election cycle began, really, and benefiting, if you will, from the focus that the campaign gave to Florida. I've seen you nod your head a couple of times in this conversation here. Make this specific to this state. How do you feel the coverage of race fared in Florida? And just, if you will, let us know how you respond to some of the points Keith's made.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'll say that, certainly in Florida, the description of somebody as black, is not specific enough here, because there are many people of African descent who live here, who are from many different countries. I mean, you can look at somebody and without hearing them speak and say, oh, that's a black person. If you ask them, like you said, and you have a little bit more of a probing intellect with it, and you ask them, well, how do you describe yourself, or journalistically, that person might say, well, I'm Cuban, I'm not black, even though they may be as of darker hue as I am, there are, aside from African Americans, to whom the term is traditionally referred, here in particular, there are Jamaican Americans, Haitian Americans, people from the Bahamas, and all over the Caribbean, who would probably not, that probably wouldn't be the first thing that they use to describe themselves as black. And I think that certainly had some significance in the way people looked at this race. But, I look back to, in terms of some of the phraseology of the campaign early on, and I think you have to go back to the primaries, where I think a lot of it came out between Clinton and Obama. Obama. And, when, nobody thought that Obama really had a shot, Clinton, quote unquote, won Florida, in which Obama did not actually compete, because of the really interesting rules, I guess that's one way you could
speaking diplomatically.
The Democratic, very diplomatically, of the Democratic Party. But along the campaign trail, Clinton, and at first there were many African Americans, in particular women, when nobody believed that Obama had a real shot, black women who were Hillary Clinton supporters, and I think a lot of that tide began to change after Clinton made some remarks about Dr. King and President Lyndon Johnson. And regarding the civil rights movement and community activism, and it was this idea that everything, all the marches that Dr. King led, and all of the movement that he inspired throughout the nation. nation, you know, the speeches he delivered that inspired people, you know, all of that wasn't really significant without a president. And I think that, you know, people, you know, of different backgrounds and ethnicities and experiences, you know, look at things differently. I think in the black community that was looked at as, oh, well, you needed a white person to basically make that happen, or else, you know, all of that marching that you all did, all of that activism, you know, it was all for naught without a white person signing off on it and making it happen. So I think that was a significant turning point, you know, and also, of course, after Obama won the Iowa caucuses, you know, it was like, oh, this guy has a shot. Further, when and you mentioned Jesse Jackson, when Bill Clinton made some comment about Jackson won, yeah, won South Carolina also, and there was something about a fairy tale or a dreamland, something along those lines. It made it seem as though, oh, well, you know, it was almost like they were saying he has no shot, you know.
Kind of, so what, really, I think it was.
Yeah, right. It's like, so what, you know, that's fine. He won one state, but so did Jesse Jackson. And I think, you know, going also back to one of your points about Obama in terms of running the running as an African American, but not running as the black candidate, you know, it was sort of a double-edged sword. Obviously, I mean, on the one hand, he doesn't want to sort of segregate himself as Jesse Jackson or the Reverend Al Sharpton, you know, who also ran, you know, and ran unsuccessful campaigns, because they were marginalized, you know, as only being for black people and not necessarily for everyone. But the other person who spoke about race among the people that you mentioned was Obama himself, and that was only after the Reverend Wright controversy, in which he was sort of forced to speak about race. He had avoided that, you know, directly addressing those issues, which are very significant issues in America, until after the Reverend Wright controversy erupted, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, this is what they're preaching in black churches. This is what a lot of black people feel, and maybe this is how Obama feels, you know. And just in terms of being, he had to come out as more of a unifier, try to talk about what people have in common and how everyone sort of needs to get past their own sort of racial prejudices. Just in terms of the whole issue of race, I mean, it was obviously a very difficult issue for everyone to sort of handle, but I think Obama essentially rose above it and got people to sort of look at themselves as, like you said, Americans, as opposed to white Americans, black Americans, you know, Hispanic, or, you know, whatever. Right. We're all part of the same country.
If I can ask you about your own paper's coverage, and it's interesting, the South Florida Times, as I understood from what you said, is a kind of a reinvention of a newspaper, a fairly recent one, and a reinvention in the age when interaction with the reporting doesn't simply happen when you write a letter to the editor and hope it gets published a week later, but the interaction is immediate. People can post comments and do all that sort of thing. Can you give us an idea quickly of what kind of reaction the readership had to your coverage or to coverage generally of the election as far as race goes?
Well, sure. And I'm sorry I didn't bring it, but we had an edition in which we distinguished ourselves from a lot of other black publications, and that on the day after the election, we had a story on our front cover with Obama sort of raising his hand, you know, and the headline saying Obama wins, and behind him was a sort of montage of photos of ancestors in black history. I'm sorry I didn't bring that. But you can go online at sfltimes.com and you could order a copy if you like. And I actually wrote a column about that in terms of how the ancestors, who such as Martin Luther King, you know, talking about the promised land, how he looked over the mountaintop and saw, you know, a better place for our people. And I said, well, he must have been looking over at Obama in Grant Park, you know, in Chicago, you know, giving his acceptance speech, you know, as the president-elect of the United States, and just how, you know, other African-Americans such as Mary McLeod Bethune, you know, looking at education as the great equalizer, you know, and sort of, you know, presaged what would happen by saying that here's what you can do. You know, if you study hard, you know, you keep your nose clean, and as a lot of our parents in the Black community would say, you know, you strive for excellence and you'd be twice as good, you know, twice as clean, twice as cautious, then you could be the president of the United States. And I think it's something that you know, it was taught to us early on. I'm not sure we really believed it until it actually happened. You know, speaking of reader reactions, I just wanted to kind of share with you a little bit of a column that our associate editor, Renee Michelle Harris, wrote about Obama jokes not being funny. And this is a message to, you know, not to the white supremacists or whatever, but this is a message to African Americans. And it just she said that as soon as the election was results were announced, she began to get a number of text messages, you know, speaking to the immediate reaction of folks. One of them read, "All white people must report to the cotton fields tomorrow at 6 a.m. sharp for orientation." Another said something to the effect that because they didn't give us 40 acres and a mule, we took the White House. You all are amused, but she actually was not, because she said that, you know, these folks who sent the text messages, you know, I'm sure it was all in fun, but they don't get it. You know, it's not about blacks dispensing payback to white, she said. What happened is so much bigger than any of us, but it's ours, all of ours. And as awesome as Obama's election is for blacks, it doesn't afford us the right to gloat or ridicule or even to blame. Does it mean that we forget slavery, Jim Crow, the bombings and the lynchings? No way. Frankly, it's because those atrocities happen that this is so sweet. That's why Jesse, Oprah, and millions of others cried tears of gratitude. Yes, we still have a long way to go, but America is growing beyond its shameful past. I think, you know, with our readers and you know, our mission is to elevate the dialogue in the community, you know, to show what people in the black community are thinking about and doing within the community as a way of making improvements in the community, having a conversation in which we seek to improve ourselves, but also to show the larger community, you know, what we're doing, and if you have an interest in us, and you know, maybe you're interested in doing business with us, or maybe you're interested in lending us a helping hand, or just maybe just understanding what is it that black folks are talking about, what is it that they're thinking. I mean, that's our mission, that's our role in the journalistic world.
Well, I believe the president-elect himself said in his speech, it's not the end but a beginning, and it seems like that's a consensus we have on this panel here. That's the end of our discussion, but the beginning of any questions that you may have, which I'm expecting you do have some. I'm sure we could continue, the three of us, but I want to share this discussion with you and the audience here. I don't believe we have a microphone for people in the audience, but if you just speak loudly enough, and if you'll allow me to paraphrase your question, I'll do that so we're sure everybody hears. So we'll start in the front there.
More commentary than a question.
Okay.
More commentary. Because I remember when it was like when I was growing up, and the issues my father had to deal with, and how by me watching my father deal with different issues, that gave me an idea of how to deal with some of those similar issues, you know, racism and discrimination, and how hopeful it is to see a situation where a lot of those old arguments about being black, being inferior, hating yourself, thinking down, all those issues can become more remote. Because he refuted a lot of those arguments. Which is a pretty amazing thing to witness, a refutation of the historical arguments about the inferiority of non-white people. major reputation of that.
And yet, Keith, if I could just bring you back to something you said at the beginning, and kind of faulting the media for not pushing hard enough on this. It's the beginning of a new way of covering race in this country. It's not the end of covering race at all. There have been some people trying to assert, some of the punditry asserting that we're in a post-racial society, and so I see you already shaking your head. My question is going to be, is that an attempt to take race relations coverage off the table? And how do you respond?
Well, I don't want to assert, again, any mind reading on the part of journalism, but I've been teaching on the subject for 14 years. I've been writing on the subject for 20. And I know from being a part of journalism and being a teacher in journalism that it's one of the things we are least happy to report on. We are least comfortable reporting on, that it is so often about us while we're writing about someone else that it becomes an incredibly difficult thing to write about. The landmines around you when you begin walking into this field are so obvious and devastating that nobody really wants to take it on. So the opportunity to get off the hook altogether and call this thing post-racial must be incredibly attractive right now to journalism. And yet, if we don't pay attention, as we didn't pay attention before Watts, as we didn't pay attention before 1968, as we didn't pay attention before Reginald Denny and Rodney King, as we didn't pay attention before the O.J. verdict, we're going to have another one of those wonderful days in America when we're going to wake up and we're going to see these stories that say, we don't see things the same in this country. And it'll be breaking news once again. As though we've learned it again. The challenge here is to recognize where we really are, what we've actually achieved by being able as a nation to elect a black man to be the president, and what we haven't achieved, and make sure that we keep reporting on the thing we haven't achieved and digging and understanding. So the story to me is not racism dead? It's a stupid question. The question really is, what role does it have in America today? And where ought we be focusing our attention the most? And that journalism can continue to do, and we ignore at our peril.
I love the way you put it in your column about how there's this bridge that's still under construction, and Obama was able to leap over the mechanisms or the mechanics, the road work that was being done to achieve this great milestone. It doesn't mean that the hurdles are not there, but if you study enough and you prepare yourself enough, and you're extraordinary enough, because anyone who would be president of the United States has to be an extraordinary person, I believe.
Should be.
Then you can actually overcome these hurdles. But that does not mean that the hurdles are not there.
Yes, a question here.
You refer to journalism as sort of a uniform type of group or profession. In other words, journalists should be doing this. But there are journalists of various stripes and represent different points of view. So that if the questions are asked by, say, the New York Times or previously the Chicago Tribune or some other Wall Street Journal, they're going to have different ways of presenting the information. It's not going to come out the same. They're not going to answer the questions. You're saying there's a basic question to be asked, and we should be getting some basic answers. But are we really going to get those basic answers, or are we going to get answers, say, the difference between Fox and MSNBC?
Well, let me make a difference between the answer and the spin. Okay? If you ask me a question and I answer it, I have given you one answer. And that is, in fact, uniform. The questions, by the way, I think are very simple questions. They are why? What do you mean? How do you know that? Simple questions that journalism doesn't ask nearly enough. But if I'm watching Fox and they don't play the answer on TV. Or if I'm watching CNN and they play it three or four times, the questions haven't changed. And I think across the board, when we look at some of the things that blew up in the Jesse Jackson comments by Bill Clinton, the Martin Luther King comments by Hillary Clinton, Geraldine Ferraro saying that Obama wouldn't have gotten where he was but for the fact that he was a black man, Barack Obama himself saying the morning after his speech in Philadelphia that his grandmother was just like she was just a typical white woman, a typical white person. All of these phrases, all of these ideas that are put forward into the public sphere require a parsing by journalists, because when Hillary Clinton says it took a president to make King's dream come true, there are many black people who heard it took a white person. I don't think that she meant that. I think what she was trying to do was minimize Obama's speech ability.
Effectiveness.
What she was trying to do was politically battle Barack Obama by minimizing the fact that he was kicking her butt as a speaker, by making speakers less relevant. But that doesn't mean that she thought it took took white people to make things happen. If journalism doesn't understand that when information goes out, it passes through different lenses and different cultures and different generations, and simply chooses, as we have, to be parrots instead of analysts, to be people who operate with mallets instead of scalpels, then what you wind up with is a terribly confused and conflicted populace that doesn't really know what we mean. And that's all I'm suggesting.
I'd love to pursue that, but it would take another hour, so we want to try to get to some questions. I want to try to be fair, and I don't believe we have anybody coming in after us, so we'll take the risk. Do we have anybody coming in?
No, we're okay.
Okay, so we'll take the risk of running a few minutes over time, and I'll reach back there. Yes. Yes, sure.
Well, and speaking of that, as newspapers fail. I'm a journalist, and watch what's happened for many years. And we go to the newspapers go, and then we only have TV, or we only have the internet. I mean, how much worse can it get? when at least in a newspaper, you pick up a newspaper, and there are several different editorials. They give people an option. But when you listen to Fox, when you listen to CNN, when you listen to any of them, you only get one perspective. And my concern is, we're going to go with this, as I think our advocates and the rest of us do.
Well, if I can just say, I think that begins to touch on what I was going to ask you about, which is the inevitable thinness of things, the race to cover a story, the 24-hour news cycle, all of that just doesn't allow for the development and the kind of history lesson that needs to be inserted to give us the perspective you're asking for.
Well, my first reaction, and it's a very visceral reaction, is to say, that's not my problem. And I don't want to suffer the consequences of journalism's troubles. So stop telling the story altogether if you can't do it right, would be my first answer. Now, I think that the... Thank you. I think that the... First of all, I think we probably have not been nearly as diverse within our organizations as we want to believe. Fox has taken it to the nth degree, obviously. But Fox is not alone out there on the sort of political polarized end of the continuum. They're less concerned about being obvious, notwithstanding their motto. But I think that first of all, the threat to democracy that is represented by what's happening to American newspapers should not be downplayed. And I don't think Americans understand enough, even today, how imperiled we are as a democracy by what's happening to American newspapers, because the journalist is the only person who has the responsibility of helping us understand what we know what we need to know in order to thrive in this democracy. Nobody else in any other profession has that job. We may not have done it well sometimes. We may not be doing it well today, but that's the responsibility. And what's happening as the economic model of newspapers continues to fail, and we are now hit with the additional uppercut of an economy in crisis, I don't think we understand, we appreciate how significant that is to the story that we're trying to tell and to the democracy that we're trying to have. When we talk about something as complex as race relations, where we have not done a very good job over the years getting good at it, and then you add on the crisis that we're confronting today, it's a new level of a problem. But the internet provides greater opportunity, and as we shake this out, as the ones that will fail and go away, and whatever the new thing is rises, the opportunity actually will increase for us to tell the more complex story, to link to things on the internet, so that if you want to understand the ancestors that you had on the front page of that paper and their connection to this, beyond simply a face and whatever it is that I knew about George Washington Carver, which is peanuts, then a link might take me deep enough through the website to understand that he invented linoleum, to understand that he made a paint out of flowers, that his inventiveness was extraordinary and way beyond peanut butter. And that's now the new opportunity for communication. But, you know, like Obama, we have to make a big leap from where we've been to where we've got to go. We can't take a slow path because technology is not waiting for us.
We have some more questions. Then we'll go to you.
And you know, I'll be as brief as. But I think that what's sort of interesting, if you look at a story that we have on our front page, you might have seen it elsewhere also. But it says that Obama is going to be the web outreach president, and you know that, and he's already done that during his campaign.
I believe the URL is change.gov. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. They must have bought that 2 years ago.
So this, you know, this traditional filter of the news media, which you know, as you pointed out, has not been very diverse. You know. Has been controlled really and dominated by white males for most of the time that it's been in existence, and you know is slowly beginning to change, but still is nowhere near as diverse as the population that it attempts to represent. You see that I believe a large part of Obama's success in this was that he was able to reach people directly, right, and circumvent the news media and that whole filter that goes along with it, and you know he would send you a text message, you know, and say, make sure you register to vote, or make sure you get to the polls today, or, you know, Obama's in Florida today. He's coming to, you know, Miami, Bicentennial Park, or whatever, you know. We're going to see more of that now. I think that, you know, mentioning that filter, you know, it's been sort of a one-sided filter for most of the time in the news media, or it's been slanted in certain ways, you know, and more recently with Fox and MSNBC and so on and so forth. Now the reader or the viewer is going to have to be the filter, and you're going to have to decide, you know, for yourself what you think is right, because you're going to be hit with so much information that it's you can't rely on anyone else now. It's got to be you.
Right. No, I promise one more question, and you right there.
Yes, I have two questions, and I would appreciate both of you could address them. The first one is, it seems to be that whenever, especially in these economic times, whenever the verbiage middle class is mentioned, I can't help but get the feeling that it's only directed towards the white middle class. And what do you think about that as journalists or working in journalism? And my second question is, it seems to me as well, and I saw this morning in C-SPAN actually, the Washington Journal, whenever Barack Obama's win is brought up, it's always juxtaposed against, oh, but then there are X amount of African-American men in prison, or what's going to happen with the fact that there's a 50% dropout rate. It always seems to me that race, that the realities that African-Americans are facing, the harsh realities in some cases, are always brought up whenever this win is mentioned. So I just want to know what you feel about those two issues, about the middle class.
Well, I think first of all, you know, until I guess around, you know, the turn of the century, in the 20th century, I mean, early on, there wasn't such a thing that was referred to as the black middle class. You know, I mean, it came about, you know, I think largely because of the Great Migration, you know, from the South to the North, and people getting, you know, better opportunities in industrialized cities in the northern states. But it's interesting, you know, when your question made me think that, you know, something that I've thought about since I was in college, which is that, you know, look, there's always what's referred to as the black middle class, and it's looked at as you know, I guess the elite or the top tier of in the black community, but you never hear much about a black upper class, you know, or the black wealthy elite or something like that, and it does exist, you know, you know, it's been sort of overlooked, marginalized, you know, forgotten. So I think when you talk about the middle class, yeah, I think in most cases the reference, you know, in the media is to the white community, and some blacks made it too, you know. but that's very interesting. What was your second question?
Right.
It speaks to this whole idea of, you know, that race in America, you know, I mean, you can be as extraordinary as you want to, and that in and of itself, you know, I mean, essentially, you know, intellectually, you know, being elected as president of the United States should allow you to then transcend, you know, whatever, you know, stereotypes or, you know, I guess, like you said, you're refuting the stereotypes. But the fact is that those stereotypes exist and people still hold them. And the fact that one black man has reached that highest pinnacle does not mean that black men in general are looked at as being intelligent or, you know, articulate, though I hate to use that word because that too has some other negative connotations. Joe Biden, right? otherwise, you know, clean cut or successful. And the reason that you're hearing that is because people still have those stereotypes, and they have not gotten past them yet.
Keith?
I want to add to that and say, first of all, I agree completely with all of that. And we have to recognize how that is coming through our ears. Is it possible that they don't mean white people, but you hear it that way, or that we hear it that way? That's one notion. But the other one is this, and that this is my big pushback on Obama and the entire campaign. That I grew up poor. And poor people didn't exist in this campaign. Poor people were essentially the beneficiaries of whatever we were going to do for the middle class. It was democratic trickle-down. It was a Democratic Party's version of trickle-down theory, that we will talk about the middle class from beginning to end, and Obama made a huge push beginning to end. In fact, that wonderful Obama commercial the week before the election was about the middle class. And it, in fact, if you saw it, it was very deliberate in portraying a diverse middle class. But they were still the middle class. They were still, maybe they were teetering on the edge of falling down, but whatever was down there never got mentioned in this campaign. Again, John Edwards leaves the campaign and so those poor people, which is kind of ironic when you know how wealthy he is. So I fret more over the fact that we are not talking enough about poverty. And once again, what will happen is that we will again delude ourselves into believing that that doesn't exist until a hurricane goes through a major American city and we are forced to watch on national television live while the product of poverty sits on rooftops in New Orleans. And we will imagine ourselves to have surmounted what we have not surmounted. So I would push again for, in journalism, for the opportunity now to look at poverty anew. On the second front, here is the paradox of race and racism and race relations in America. There is an opportunity, because a black man is sitting in office, for an attention to be brought to problems that we would just as soon ignore and wait for the studies to come out to produce the next set of statistics. We have a problem for young black men in America. We have a problem in our educational systems, in public education systems in a country where our black and brown people are most affected. We have issues around the very things that we would not want a whole race to be associated with, but that does exist, that could be brought, elevated to a different place, exactly because not only do we have a black man in office, but we have an intelligent man in office. We have a man in office who can grasp, synthesize, and feed back eloquently to the country what our problems are and where our challenges are, and can unite people around those issues. Heaven help us if he doesn't talk about those issues through the next 8 years. Our challenge as a society is to be able to hear a black man talk about a black man's problems and recognize that it's an American speaking, and make that leap that is so difficult for us to make, in which I can be the black man that I am, and the father that I am, and the son and a brother and a citizen that I am, and there can be different people at different times. And that black president can be the president sometimes and a black man sometimes, and we're comfortable with that.
Well, thank you very much, Keith Woods. Keith Woods, Dean of Faculty at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg. Thank you for joining us. Bradley Bennett, Executive Editor of South Florida Times. My name is Chris Keneally. Appreciate your attendance here at the Miami Book Fair. Thank you very much.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.